Welcome to the Black Mass. Tonight, two tales by Edgar Allan Poe. First, a story about a phantom that you might see in your own city streets at any time. Here is Bernard Mays to tell you about The Man in the Crowd.
There are some secrets which do not permit themselves to be told. Men die nightly in their beds, wringing the hands of ghostly confessors and looking them piteously in the eyes. Die of despair of heart and convulsion of throat on account of the hideousness of mysteries which will not suffer themselves to be revealed. Now and then, alas, the conscience of man takes up a burden so heavy in horror that it can be thrown down only into the grave. And thus, the essence of all crime is undivulged. Not long ago, about the closing in of an evening in autumn, I sat at the large bay window of a coffee house in London, peering through the smoky panes into the street, one of the principal thoroughfares of the city. As the darkness came on, the throng momentarily increased. Two dense and continuous tides of population were rushing past the door. At first, I looked at the passengers in masses. Soon, however, I descended to details and regarded with minute interest the innumerable variety. The greater number had a satisfied, business-like demeanor, others restless, talking to themselves. The tribe of clerks, one breed wearing the cast-off graces of the gentry, another the affectation of respectability. Descending the scale of what is termed gentility, darker and deeper themes, beggars, ghastly and feeble invalids, drunkards. As the night deepened, the late hour brought forth every species of infamy from its den, and deepened in me also the interest of the scene. With my brow to the glass, I was thus occupied in scrutinizing the mob, when suddenly there came into view a countenance, that of a decrepit old man, some 65 or 70 years of age, a countenance which at once arrested and absorbed my whole attention. There arose within my mind the ideas of vast mental power, of caution, of penuriousness, of avarice, coolness, malice, of bloodthirstiness, of triumph, of merriment, of excess terror, of intense, of extreme despair. I felt singularly aroused and fascinated. Then came a craving desire to keep the man in view, to know more of him. I made my way into the street and pushed through the crowd in the direction which I had seen him take. I at length came up within sight of him, approached and followed him closely, yet cautiously, so as not to attract his attention. He was short in stature, very thin, and apparently very feeble. His clothes generally were filthy and ragged. It was now fully nightfall, and the humid fog had ended in a settled, heavy rain. For half an hour, the old man held his way with difficulty along the great thoroughfare, and I walked close at his elbow through fear of losing sight of him. Never once turning his head to look back, he didn't observe me. By and by, he passed into a cross street, not quite so much thronged as the one he quitted. He walked more slowly, more hesitatingly. He crossed and recrossed the way repeatedly without apparent aim. The street was a narrow and long one, and his course lay within it for nearly an hour, during which the passengers had gradually diminished. A turn brought us into a square, brilliantly lighted and overflowing with life. He urged his way steadily and perseveringly. I was surprised, however, to find, upon his having made the circuit of the square, that he turned and retraced his steps, repeating the same walk several times, once nearly detecting me as he came round with a sudden movement. In this exercise, he spent another hour. The rain fell fast, the air grew cool, and the people were retiring to their homes. With a gesture of impatience, the wanderer passed into a by-street, comparatively deserted. Down this, some quarter of a mile long, he rushed with an activity I couldn't have dreamed of seeing in one so aged. A few moments later brought us into a large and busy bazaar, and he forced his way to and fro without aim among the host of buyers and sellers. At no moment did he see me that I watched him. He entered shop after shop, priced nothing, spoke no word, looked at all objects with a wild and vacant stare. I was now utterly amazed at his behaviour. I was resolved to follow him wherever he went, and that we should not part until I had satisfied myself in some measure respecting him. By 11 o'clock, the company were fast deserting the bazaar. A shopkeeper, in putting up a shutter, jostled the old man. He shuddered and hurried into the street, looked anxiously around him for an instant, and then ran with incredible swiftness through many crooked and peopled lanes, until we emerged once more upon the great thoroughfare whence we had started. It was still brilliant with gas, but the rain fell fiercely, and there were few persons to be seen. The stranger grew pale, then with a heavy sigh, turned in the direction of the river, and plunging through a great variety of devious ways, came out at length in view of one of the principal theatres. The audience were thronging from the doors. The old man gasped as if for breath and threw himself into the crowd. Eventually the company grew more scattered, and his old uneasiness and vacillation were resumed. For some time, he followed closely a party of some 10 or 12 roisterers. But one by one, they dropped off. In a narrow and gloomy lane, the stranger paused, and for a moment seemed lost in thought. And then, with every mark of agitation, pursued rapidly a route which brought us to the most noisome quarter of London. Everything wore the worst impress of the most deplorable poverty and crime. Tall, antique, worm-eaten wooden tenements, horrible, filthy, festered in the dammed-up gutters. The whole atmosphere teemed with desolation. Yet as we proceeded, the sounds of human life revived. Large bands of the most abandoned London populace were seen reeling to and fro. The spirits of the old man again flickered up, as a lamp which is near its death's hour. Once more he strode onward. Suddenly a corner was turned. A blaze of light burst upon our sight, and we stood before one of the huge suburban temples of intemperance. It was now nearly daybreak, and a number of wretched inebriates were still pressing in and out. With half a shriek of joy, the old man forced a passage within. He stalked backward and forward, without apparent object, among the throng. When finally they were gone, it was something even more intense than despair that I then observed. Yet he didn't hesitate, but with a mad energy, he retraced his steps at once to the heart of the mighty London. Long and swiftly he fled, while I followed him in the wildest amazement, resolute not to abandon the scrutiny in which I now felt an interest all-absorbing. The sun rose while we proceeded, and when we had reached the most thronged part of the populous town, it presented an appearance of human bustle and activity scarcely inferior to what I had seen on the evening before. And here, long among the increasing confusion, did I persist in my pursuit of the stranger. But, as usual, he walked to and fro, and during the day didn't pass out from the turmoil of the street. As the shades of the second evening passed on, I grew wearied unto death, and stopping full in front of the wanderer, gazed at him steadfastly in the face. He noticed me not, but resumed his solemn walk. This old man is the type and genius of deep crime. He refuses to be alone. He's the man of the crowd. It will be in vain to follow. I shall learn no more of him nor of his deeds, for he doesn't permit himself to be read.
That was Bernard Mays in The Man in the Crowd by Edgar Allan Poe. Our second story by Poe is also about a phantom, this one on the high seas. Here is Edgar Allan Poe's MS Found in a Bottle. Of my country and of my family, I have little to say. Ill usage and length of years have driven me from the one and estranged me from the other. Hereditary wealth afforded me a life spent mainly in foreign travel, terminated, finally, by the incredible events here related. I had set out from the port of Batavia on a voyage to the archipelago islands. I went as passenger, having no other inducement than a kind of nervous restlessness which haunted me as a fiend. We got underway with a mere breath of wind, and for many days stood along the eastern coast of Java. One evening, leaning against the taffrail, I observed a very singular isolated cloud to the northwest. At sunset, it spread, girding the horizon like a long line of low beach. My notice was soon after attracted by the dusky red appearance of the moon and the very peculiar character of the sea. The water seemed more than usually transparent. The air became intolerably hot, and as night came on, every breath of wind died away. A more entire calm it is impossible to conceive. The flame of a candle burned upon the poop without the least perceptible motion. The crew, consisting principally of Malays, stretched themselves deliberately upon the deck. I went below, not without a full presentiment of evil. My uneasiness, however, prevented me from sleeping, and about midnight, I decided to go up upon deck. As I placed my foot upon the upper step of the companion ladder,
I found the ship quivering. Quivering to its very center. And in the next instant, a wilderness of foam hurled us upon our beam ends. And rushing over us fore and aft, swept the entire deck from stem to stern. The extreme fury of the blast proved the salvation of the ship. She rose after a minute heavily from the sea and staggering a while beneath the immense pressure of the tempest, finally righted. By what miracle I escaped destruction, it is impossible to say. Stunned by the shock of the water, I found myself upon recovery, jammed in between the stern post and the rudder. I regained my feet. It seemed we were among breakers so terrible. Beyond the wildest imagination was the whirlpool of mountainous and foaming ocean within which we were engulfed. Oh, oh, oh. It was the old Swede. He came reeling aft.
Gold, all gold, Swede, all gold.
All on deck, with the exception of ourselves, had been swept overboard. And those below must have perished while they slept. The cabins were deluged with water. The main fury of the blast had already blown over, and we apprehended little danger from the violence of the wind. For 5 entire days and nights, during which our only subsistence was a small quantity of jaggeree procured with great difficulty from the forecastle, for 5 entire days and nights the hulk flew at a rate defying computation before rapidly succeeding flaws of the wind. Our course for the first 4 days was southeast by south. On the 5th day, the cold became extreme. The sun arose with a sickly yellow luster, and clambered a very few degrees above the horizon, emitting no decisive light. There were no clouds apparent. Yet the wind was upon the increase and blew with a fitful and unsteady fury. About noon, our attention was again arrested by the appearance of the sun.
Rebel sun, light all gone too.
It gave out no light, properly so called, but a dull and sullen glow, without reflection, as if its rays were polarized. And just before sinking, its central powers suddenly went out, as if hurriedly extinguished by some unaccountable power. It was a dim, silver-like rim alone as it rushed down the unfathomable sea.
Moon. Gone down the sea.
We waited in vain for the arrival of the 6th day. That day to me has not yet arrived. To the Swede, it never did arrive. Thenceforward, we were enshrouded in pitchy darkness, so that we could not have seen an object 20 paces from the ship. Eternal night continued to envelop us. All around us were horror and thick gloom. A black, sweltering desert of ebony. Superstitious terror crept by degrees into the spirit of the old Swede. We had no means of calculating time. We were aware of having made far to the south. Every mountainous billow hurried to overwhelm us. The swell surpassed anything I had imagined possible. The swelling of the black, stupendous seas became more dismally appalling. At times we gasped for breath at an elevation beyond the albatross. At times became dizzy with the velocity of our descent into some watery hell. We were at the bottom of one of these abysses when...
Oh! Oh, see! See! Almighty God, see!
A dull, sullen glare of red light streamed down the sides of the vast chasm where we lay. At a terrific height above us, and on the very verge of the precipitous descent, hovered a gigantic ship. Her huge hulls of a deep, dingy black, and she bore up under a press of sail in the very teeth of that supernatural sea. For a moment of intense terror, she paused upon the giddy pinnacle as if in contemplation of our own sublimity. Then trembled and tottered and came down! The shock of the descending mass had struck us. I had been hurled here upon the rigging of the stranger. And finally, dizzy, in a dream, I was on the deck. I staggered to the main hatchway, then secreted myself in the hold. Why, I can hardly tell. An indefinite sense of awe had taken hold of my mind. A feeling for which I have no name has taken possession of my soul. A sensation which will admit of no analysis, to which the lessons of bygone time are inadequate, and for which I fear futurity will offer me no key. To a mind constituted like my own, the latter consideration is an evil. I shall never be satisfied with regard to the nature of my conceptions. Yet is it not wonderful that these conceptions are indefinite, since they have their origin in sources so utterly novel? A new sense, a new entity is added to my soul. It is long since I first trod the decks of this terrible ship. Incomprehensible men, wrapped up in meditations of a kind which I cannot divine, they pass me by unnoticed. Concealment is utter folly on my part, for the people will not see. Just now I passed directly before the eyes of the mate. I ventured into the captain's own private cabin and took thence the materials with which I write. I shall, from time to time, continue this journal. It is true that I may not find an opportunity of transmitting it to the world, but I will not fail to make the endeavor. At the last moment, I will enclose the manuscript in a bottle and cast it within the sea. An incident occurred. I had thrown myself down upon the deck, and while musing upon the singularity of my fate, I unwittingly daubed with a tar brush the edges of a neatly folded studding sail which lay near me. Now the sail is rigged, and I look up and see the thoughtless touches of the brush spread out in the wind, spelling the word discovery. I have made observations upon the structure of the ship. What she is, I fear it is impossible to say. Her huge size and overgrown suits of canvas. Simple bow, antiquated stern. There flashes across my mind a sensation of familiar things. Indistinct shadows of recollection. There is a peculiar character about the wood which strikes me as rendering it unfit for the purpose to which it has been applied. I mean its extreme porousness. It would have every characteristic of Spanish oak if Spanish oak were distended by any unnatural means. A curious apothegm comes full upon my recollection. It is as sure as there is a sea where the ship itself will grow in bulk like the living body of the seamen. I stood among a group of the crew. They paid me no manner of attention. They all bore about them the marks of a hoary old age. Their knees trembled, their shoulders bent. Shriveled skins rattled in the wind. Their eyes glistened with the rheum of years. Around them, on every part of the deck, lay mathematical instruments of the most quaint and obsolete construction. I see the captain face to face in his own cabin. And I regard him with a feeling of irrepressible reverence and awe and wonder. The singularity of the expression which reigns upon the face, the intense, the thrilling evidence of old age, so utter, so extreme. His gray hairs are records of the past. His grayer eyes are symbols of the future. His head was bowed down upon his hands, and it pored with a fiery, unquiet eye over a paper which I took to be a commission. He murmured to himself, and his voice seemed to reach my ears from a great distance. The ship continues her course due south, and colossal waters rear their heads above us like demons of the deep, but like demons forbidden to destroy. All in the immediate vicinity of the ship is the blackness of eternal night and the chaos of foamless water. But now, about a league on either side of us may be seen, indistinctly and at intervals, stupendous ramparts of ice. Ice towering away into the desolate sky, and looking like the walls of the universe. The ship proves to be within the influence of some strong current or impetuous undertow, which, now howling and shrieking by the white ice, thunders on to the southward with a velocity like the headlong dashing of a cataract. Conceive the horror of my sensations is utterly impossible. Yet a curiosity to penetrate the mysteries of these awful regions predominates even over my despair and will reconcile me to the most hideous aspect of death. It is evident that we are hurrying onward to some exciting knowledge, some never-to-be-imparted secret whose attainment is destruction. The ship is at times lifted bodily from out of the sea. Horror! The ice opens suddenly to the right and to the left, and we are whirling dizzily in immense concentric circles, round and round the borders of a gigantic amphitheater, the summit of whose walls is lost in the darkness and the distance. But little time will be left to me to ponder upon my destiny.
The circles rapidly grow small, smaller and smaller. We are plunging madly within the grasp of the whirlpool. The ship is quivering, oh God, and going down, going down.
That was M.S. Found in a Bottle by Edgar Allan Poe. The technical production was by John Whiting, and the story was adapted and performed by your host of the Black Mass, Eric Bauersfeld. And now, good night.